The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, number 110 for Monday, July 2nd,
2007. Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab. I'm Dave Hamilton. I'm here with John Braun. Hi, John.
Wow, I kind of lost track of time there. I had trouble getting that out.
The date?
But then I'm on vacation. Well, I'm taking tomorrow off. And then, you know, Wednesday, of course, we celebrate our independence.
That's right.
Or at least we do here in Connecticut.
But tonight we celebrate our interdependence as John and I rely on each other to deliver you the best podcast we possibly can.
How? Where'd you get that?
Don't you like that? That's good stuff.
That was great.
I pulled that right out of the top of my head. So today's show, as promised, is going to feature up front some reviews and then a couple of things that John has and one thing that I looked at this week. And then we've got some tips for you in answer to your questions and, of course, from you in response to previous shows. So I don't have really anything else to add, so let's just jump right into this. John, why don't you start here? And I believe the first product that we're talking about today is something called File Juicer. Why don't you tell us what that is?
And yes, we'll go from there. And this is great because, you know, I love talking about what interests me. Because a lot of times it's about these other people. But oh, I'm sorry. Well, okay, if you're still listening, here we go. So anyways, thanks, yes, yeah. this was part of a recent Monday's Mac Gadget, which some of you know that, you know, on occasion I like to write this. But I found this really, really cool utility that once I found it, I can't imagine doing without it, because it reminds me of a days of, in the past of Apple where, and you may remember this, Dave, but, you know, Apple files were always kind of weird in that they have different parts, a resource fork, a data fork, and just getting data out of them was always kind of interesting. Now, you probably remember ResEdit, Dave.
Of course.
Which in the old days was this thing, resource editor, because, you know, Apple files were kind of cutting edge and having this concept of a data fork and a resource fork where resources would be all the things like the icons and other fun things that would, you know, make a file do what it does. Now, with OS X, it's not that clear to me sometimes how to get at, because you know a lot of files, there's all sorts of things like graphics and sounds and cool stuff.
Sure.
But short of, from the Finder, what you can do is, if you click on an application, you right-click typically, or Control-Kick, whatever, click, you'll get a choice in the contextual menu called Show Package Contents. And that kind of digs in, because a lot of Apple files aren't what they seem. Like, applications are typically a .app file, and you can dig into them. And there's different structures, different files. But short of that, there's really no way to get into what's inside of a file. And, you know, a lot of times it's really interesting stuff. So I just came across this thing, and now that I've used it, it's awesome. So it's called File Juicer. And as the name implies, it squeezes all the juice or all the good stuff out of a file. And it really couldn't be easier. And it has, you know, a couple of major modes. The one major mode, you know, again, it couldn't be easier, is you take a file, you drag it on top of File Juicer, and it will then create a folder with subfolders for the file types that it pulls out. So if it finds GIF files, it'll make a little GIF folder under the application folder, of course.
Okay, yeah, sure.
So it makes one folder for whatever the name of the app is, and then it makes these subfolders, so it could be JPEGs, it could be PNGs, it could be GIFs, it could be sounds. I believe there's about 25 file types that this supports. So that's one thing it does, and it's just, it does it very, very well. And actually, you may be surprised sometimes at what's inside of files. And actually, I was, you know, emailing back and forth with the author, and one thing he suggested, which I think would peg the geek meter, is, you know how you always wonder what's going on in a system update when you get a software update?
Oh, sure.
It's usually
yeah.
stored in your receipts folder. Well, he said, hey, you know, this is a cool way to really kind of dig in and find some of the juicy stuff there, like especially maybe a new graphic or a new icon that may hint at, you know, some secret stuff that may be coming. So that's one thing that it does. Now, another thing that it does also is that it knows about a lot of the caches, excuse me, on your in a lot of applications. So, for example, Safari has a cache, Spotlight has a cache, all sorts of things store these little temporary files. And what it does, it knows about all of these. So if you run the app and then you select from the menu one of these caches, I asked it to show me some dashboard stuff.
Okay.
I'm sorry, not Spotlight, dashboard. And it was bringing up little graphics from one of the weather applications that I have in dashboard. So I just say this is really a great tool, especially for people that are really wondering, you know, what's kind of buried in my system and what may I not want buried in my system. And finally, the last thing that it does is it can, like some other applications, but it will recover deleted things from flash media, as you probably know. But if you don't, a lot of times when you delete something, it doesn't really delete it. It just kind of marks it. And especially with flash memory, because it's relatively slow, you don't want to actually scrub the whole thing. You just want to kind of put a marker saying, okay, come back and use this space later.
Sure.
So that's another thing that it does. Yeah. So I just think it's really cool. And you're going to find, you know, you probably find a lot of garbage that you don't care about. But every now and then you may find a little gem information inside of a file. So, we're going to link to it, or, you know, we'll link to the gadget that talks. Oh, you can also automate it. So you can do file actions if you'd like to. Has automator support. So just all sorts of great stuff. And right now it's up to version 4.8. It's only $15, $14.95. It does have some restrictions. It's not crippled, but, you know, put some little watermarks, and I think there are size limitations. So definitely check it out if you haven't already, Dave.
Cool. Yeah, I actually... completely separate from this review, I had met Enrique, I guess is his name, the gentleman who wrote this, while I was at WWDC in the go-to-market lab.
Okay. And he runs Echo One.
Echo One, that's right. And he and I had an opportunity to chat, and he said the thing that brings people to his site for File Juicer more than anything else is searching for Mac and EXE files, because it will extract if an EXE file just contains, say, you know, flash or images or movies, it'll suck all that stuff out of it, and that can be really handy. And so we went and searched for it, and he wanted to show me that this is how it did it. And the second or third thing that came up, his was of course the first, and the second or third thing that came up on Google was an old Ask Dave column from like 7 years ago, dealing with the same thing, but of course long before File Juicer came out. So we just had a nice little laugh over it. But it'll pull out all the stuff that's buried in those EXE files, unless it's a program, in which case there's nothing to pull out. And at that point,
EXE
you've got
file. Oh, yeah. You sound like a DOS guy.
That's right. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. That being, of course, an executable, right? For those.
Right. Right.
They've been shielded from the horrors of
.exe DOS
and
files. That's right. Cool. All right. Well, we will link to that. Okay. So I have had the opportunity for the last couple of weeks to take a look at an Apple TV here. And I've actually, I say here, I mean back over at the house, way on the other side of the driveway. Not here, but there. That's right. And it's been an interesting little tour. I guess I'll start with the setup here. Pulling it out of the box it's simple. It's the Apple TV, the remote, and a power cord. Transformer.
It kind of looks like a Mac Mini.
Yes,
it
sure does.
The case design seems very similar to a lot of the hard drives out there now. So kind of square but kind of rounded.
Yeah, square with rounded corners and flat.
I'm sorry, but again, out of the box experience. Hopefully, it's the same as most Apple stuff. It's like, you know, telling a story as you take it out of the box and you get it the documentation and all that.
You do.
But how did the setup go?
Okay, so the setup, the most difficult part about the setup was figuring out what ports to use on my television and digital receiver to hook it up. And that's only because we have so much other stuff hooked up that I had to do a bit of juggling just to free up the right ports to make this work. I wound up hooking it up to the HDMI port on our TV and a digital light pipe port for audio on our digital receiver.
Interesting, because HDMI can carry both audio and video, but you opted for breaking out the audio, or higher quality audio, I guess.
Well, HDMI will carry higher quality audio, but it's carrying it to my television, whereas I don't want the audio carried to my television. I want it carried to my digital receiver so that it can... because that's what drives my speakers.
Gotcha.
Our television doesn't do any of that. So it could, but our receiver's better. So I did that. Now, the one item of note is that the Apple TV does not come with any of the cables that you would need. So you need to be aware of how you're... And that's because they would have to include all sorts of different cables, right? They'd have to include HDMI and component, and then they'd have to include... light pipe and regular, you know, analog left and right stereo.
Yeah. That's where TiVo, I think, is nice in that, well, again, you're paying $800 for it.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
But they did toss in an HDMI cable when I bought it. And I think, yeah, you also have the Series 2.
Series
now, how
TiVo.
About, because I remember, not to compare it to, well, we'll compare it to TiVo. I don't know. Maybe it's a valid comparison. But did they have a, because I remember the TiVo had a lot of very nice diagrams say, okay, if you got this set up and these devices.
Oh, yeah.
Here's the cables and here's the stuff you need. So was it pretty straightforward in guiding you? I mean, you've already been through it, so you're probably pretty knowledgeable. But was it pretty clear for a beginner what cables and all that they need to get it working?
Yeah, you're right. I didn't even look at the manual. I just hooked it up.
Okay.
But I then looked at the manual to make sure that it was fairly clear. And it is. Again, though, if you need some working knowledge of your home entertainment setup, if you've got some convoluted setup and you're not entirely sure how it works, your best bet would be to go with HDMI and just plug it into your TV and hope that the way things are, the rest of the stuff is set up, that the sound carries through the rest of the deal, which it could, and would likely work. But you know, once it was installed, I just turned it on and up it came. And then the first thing you do is you marry it to you connect it to your wireless network or a wired network. It'll do either. I opted for wireless because I don't have an Ethernet port strung into my living room. So I connected it wireless to my AirPort Extreme. No, AirPort. I get so confused with the name. My AirPort 802.11g base station. And
G. Okay, now I thought, now help me out here, but I thought the Apple TV was an N device, or
it
has
is.
The potential.
It has the potential to go all the way up to N. In the house, I've only got up to G. And more on that, on the speed of that later.
Okay.
And so you connected up to that, and that went fine. It actually connected to my WPA2 network, and it was no problem. And then you start marrying it to iTunes libraries. And the way you do that is it gives you a passcode on the screen. You go to your computer. The computer in iTunes will see the Apple TV. You tell it, yep, connect, type in the same passcode, and bam, you're good to go. Now, you can hook this up to 5 different Macs or Windows PCs running iTunes in your house, and you can stream from 5 of those. You can sync from one of them, and the difference is that when it's synced, it actually copies data that you specify. It's very similar to connecting an iPod, where you go into iTunes and you say, look, here's the Apple TV, and I want to copy, you know, the 2 most recent movies and, or maybe 5 most recent movies and the 2 most recent episodes of all unwatched TV shows. And I want to copy these particular podcasts and this particular music playlist and these particular pictures, et cetera, et cetera. And you can actually prioritize pictures over anything else, that you've got some nice pictures on the Apple TV as your screensaver, and it actually will scroll through those in this 3D view.
So like we said before, so it's still one, like we commented before, one iTunes library to one device. So the streaming is multiple, so it sounds like they're kind of hearing what people need, but
exactly.
But it's still a one-to-one deal. One iTunes library to one Apple TV?
To sync to it. Now, again, syncing copies from iTunes over the network to Apple TV. Now, the beauty of that is you can then take that iTunes library and walk away with it. You can shut the computer down. You can take the computer off the network, and all the content that was synced previously to the Apple TV still lives there. And it will stay there until, you know, you come back and resync and either pull stuff off or add new stuff on. Streaming, as the name implies, requires the iTunes library to be active and on the network. And streaming works very, very well. The trick is, the way it works is you essentially have one view of the world. And your view of the world is either what's on my Apple TV or what's going to be streamed from one particular Mac. So you can't aggregate all of the content at once. Let's say you're looking for a particular song. You can't just start searching through music and have it go out and look at all of the libraries that are out there at once. You say, look, I think it's on my wife's computer, so I'm going to change my view of the world to her computer, sync up with that. Not sync, but lock into that, and then browse the library over the network and then stream whatever song it is that I want, or whatever TV show, or whatever movie.
Okay, so the movie has to be within another iTunes?
Yes.
I just want to make sure. Okay, so yes. it's not the one that's married to it, but it's one of the five that you select.
And correct.
So from within iTunes, you can then say the target is my Apple TV device.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Maybe I'm not explaining this right. One iTunes library is the one that syncs, and that's the one that actually copies data to it. If you're streaming, though, you choose that from the Apple TV with your remote sitting on the couch.
I'm sorry. Okay. So from the Apple TV, you choose the remote library that has the...
Bingo.
So then are you limited by the file types that are supported by iTunes?
Correct. That's absolutely right.
To be MPEG-4, I guess?
Yeah, MPEG. iTunes actually supports quite a few.
Or AVI and
correct.
Depending on the if you have the right code, so you may have to add a. Did you have to add any codecs? Or
I didn't. No, I was able to play everything that I had. That I tried in my iTunes library, but of course my iTunes library is already geared to work with my iPod, and any file types that work with the iPod work with Apple TV. So I probably wouldn't have run into those problems because I've already scrubbed my iTunes library and converted things that that wouldn't work with the iPod. So
cool. And now the streaming, did that work okay? Because N is roughly twice as fast as G, right?
That's right.
So G is 54 megabits and then N is 10
yeah, and
something.
N is actually faster than G because G really runs at half its speed and N actually runs faster than half its speed. But so here's the thing. I've got, like I said, the Series 3 TiVo basically sitting in the same place as the Apple TV. The Series 3 TiVo, when I transmit data, and it's got a TiVo wireless adapter, so presumably it's married as well as it could possibly be. The fastest that I've seen data transfer is like 800K over my wireless network. And now this is going clear across the house, so I kind of figure, all right, well, that's the wireless range, and that's just how it's going to be. One corner of the house to the complete opposite corner of the house. When I hooked up the Apple TV and started syncing my computer to it, it was going at almost, 27 megabits. 27 megabits, 2.7 megabytes. It was nearly going full speed of the wireless network. So either TiVo's doing something horribly wrong or Apple's doing something amazingly right to really get the most out of the wireless signal. And it's probably a combination of the two.
I remember the TiVo was kind of picky. Like, actually, the Series 3, well, you ran into this. There's only one adapter that you can use with the TiVo.
Yeah, and that's what I've
theirs.
Got. Yeah.
Officially supported.
That's right.
Maybe you can get another one working. I don't know. I know on the prior TiVos, you could get another alternate brand.
Yep.
But anyways, okay, so the streaming was satisfactory?
It totally fine. Lisa and I watched a couple of episodes of Weeds on the thing, which is a series that we don't get because we don't have Showtime here. And we streamed those to it, and it was totally fine. You select the episode and hit play, and it pretty much starts right away. There was very, very almost unnoticeable delay, maybe a little bit of lag. I don't know, but certainly nothing worth complaining about. And the I have two things to say about the video quality. I've pulled a lot of stuff from our Series 2 TiVo onto my Mac, so TV shows and that sort of thing. Now, the TiVos can't talk to each other because of the way the Series 3 works, but my Mac can talk to the Apple TV. Everything that I've converted for TiVo on my Mac is at iPod quality because that's where I would have been watching it. I streamed some of that stuff back to Apple TV, and it actually looks really good. We watched an episode The Twilight Zone last night, and it looked really, really sharp. They've got to be doing some massive up conversion in the Apple TV to make that stuff look good. So whatever they're doing there works really, really well. It's an Apple product. It's so easy to use that you almost forget how much it can do. You know, the remote has six buttons. You know, right? It's just the same remote that you would get with your all the new Macs. Now, I did sync it up with my Logitech Harmony remote, and it worked fine. So I didn't even have to use the Apple remote, and it works fine. There's no complaints. The remote is very responsive. There's no lag or any weird delays when you press buttons. It just works, and it scrolls through menus, and then of course you can go online and and download, you know, movie trailers and see that stuff, and that stuff just starts right away.
And I think YouTube, right?
And now YouTube.
Isn't that the big deal with the latest version is that they added the ability for you. Now, from the Apple TV, you then just connect to YouTube and you can search for things?
Yeah.
Is that how it works?
You set your view of the world to the Apple TV, and then there's a YouTube option in the menu, and you can start browsing YouTube. You can actually log into your own YouTube account if you've got one and view all your favorites there. Not everything is converted for use on Apple TV yet. The folks at Google YouTube say that they're in the process of doing that. And, of course, I'm sure that's true. So not everything that I tried to watch worked. But of the stuff that that was converted, it, you know, yeah, just came in just fine. Just like you would expect it to. There was nothing special about the experience because it worked so seamlessly, right? You just plug it in and it works. Now, comparing that to what I had previously, which was the ability to get photos and music on my TV or on my home entertainment unit via TiVo, and that works okay, but this is so much better than that. Largely because it's all built by the same company, right? You know, you've got Apple on one end and Apple on the other. Browsing your music library is so much faster and so much more seamless. Browsing for photos, again, it's just right there. The stuff just works. Very, very smooth. Very, very simple experience. And again, it just works. You know, if you're watching a movie on your Apple TV, and you pause the movie there, and then you sync to your iPod from your computer, and you go onto the airplane, and you start watching. The movie resumes from the spot that you paused it on the Apple TV. All that stuff is carried through, just like you would expect it to be. But again, you know, they've looked that far ahead to make sure that that functionality is just nice and smooth. One complaint that I have about it, and this is because I'm a TiVo guy, is the Apple TV only connects digitally, right, to your TV. So if you don't have a TV with an HDMI or component hookup, it's not going to work. Along those lines, the Apple TV forces you to pick a fixed output resolution. Now, what that means is, let's say, you know, you decide that, okay, I'm going to fix my output resolution to 720p. Well, if you've got 480p content, the Apple TV is going to upconvert that to 720p and spit it to your TV, and your TV is going to think that it's at 720p. Similarly, if you set the output of the Apple TV to 1080i, the same thing would happen. 480p, the same thing would happen. What I've become accustomed to, and this is because TiVo does it, is TiVo has what they call a native mode, where the TiVo doesn't muck with the signal at all. Whatever it comes through as is what it passes it to the TV. With our TV, which happens to be a fairly high-quality TV with great converters, our TV takes care of the conversion from 480p to whatever the native resolution of our TV is, or from 720p to the native resolution, or 1080i. And I like the way that our TV converts that stuff. It does some great stuff with standard def, where it fills the screen but doesn't make it look all stretched. And I really like that. That's not something that I can do easily with the Apple TV. And their reason for doing it is understandable. They don't want you to wind up going through mode switches every time you shift to new content, which on some TVs can cause flickering and that sort of thing, depending on how it's connected. But it would be a nice option to have, even with a warning that, well, you might not like the side effects, but if you're okay with that, well, here you go. Again, that's not Apple's bag, so I can understand why they didn't do it. But it is, having the TiVo, it is a feature that I miss. So, and then my only other complaint is you can't buy from the couch. If you're watching a TV show and you get to the end of a particular episode, it'd be great if I could just buy the next episode, and as soon as it's done downloading, start watching it. Not an option.
Yeah.
You have to go back to the computer to buy it, wait for it to download there, and then come back to the Apple TV. Again, simplifies the process, understand why they did it, but I'd sure like to be able to buy TV shows, movies, and songs from sitting on the couch. And I think, frankly, they'd sell a lot more if you could view the trailer for a movie and say, hey, let's watch that, press the button, and boom.
But there you go. I'm sure in the secret Apple labs buried deep within Cupertino that they're working on that.
I would imagine, yeah. I mean, it stands to reason. I mean, there's no reason to get off the couch, right? But then again, you know, while I'm sure you're right that they're working on it, unless they can make it work the way they want it to work, we'll never see it in the product.
Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah, it's a solid device. It does exactly what you would expect it to do in a very easy to use package. It extends what you have on your computer to your HD TV in all its glory. And that's exactly what you'd want. It's not a blow me away product simply because it works so well. Does that make sense?
No. Because, you know, to me, I mean, the TiVo was like a paradigm shift.
Yeah.
You know, it was just like, oh my gosh, all of a sudden I can do this. So we're probably desensitized to the whole, you know, being able to watch stuff when you want versus when it's being broadcast or sent over your cable. So
yeah,
that's a good desensitized
point. That's a good point. Yeah, I've been a TiVo guy for what, 6+ years now. So yeah, I'm totally desensitized to that paradigm shift.
Did you see the deal? I just got this. I actually got to tell my family because the rest of my family still has Series 1 with lifetime memberships.
Yeah,
and I just got an email saying, hey, you want a Series 2? We'll let you transfer the lifetime.
Oh, that's cool.
Pretty nice deal.
That's good.
Because, yeah, the even the 2 has something over the 1, you know, the networking and stuff like that. So anyways.
And you can do dual tuner on the 2. So.
Yes. Yeah. So, cool. Excellent. So,
there you go. The geeky view of the Apple TV. That's
very nice. And then I just want to mention, can I talk about one more thing?
Sure.
Okay. So one of the cool things being, you know, here in the hip and happening, you know, area of Connecticut is that every now and then these groups will have these little events here in New York City. And that's just a ride on the, you know, rusty, broken down, you know, nearly unusable train service we have here. Hello, Governor, get something going on, or somebody. Anyways, yeah, our train service is pretty hurting. Right, Dave?
Yeah.
I don't know if you've been on it lately, but anyways, it's better than walking or driving, though.
Right.
Because, yeah, driving in the city, New York City is terrible. So anyways, there was this one event that I popped into. It was only a few hours, but it was a lot of the vendors it wasn't really a Mac event, but, you know, I always like to go to these just to keep in touch with the vendors. It was called Digital Experience, which is, you know, just the assembly of, you know, several major vendors. But the cool thing is that I got this piece of, I guess we call it swag, which is handouts. And this just caught my eye. So just talk about it briefly. So
what is it?
Our good friends at Qualcomm gave it to me. Okay. So it's a flash drive, but it's different from, so the one I had before, and I also linked to this as I wrote a little, did a write-up on this, is it was, so I had one drive that I actually purchased because I washed my my iPod Shuffle. So I needed a new flash drive, and I got one, I think it was Lexar, and it had a little fuel gauge on it using this e-ink technology. So when it was like an LCD, but when you pulled it out, it stayed there, and I'm like, well, that's pretty cool. So I actually purchased one of those. But then they gave this little handout, and every now and then you get a real, you know, cool one. And then I looked at it, and this one had the capacity of the drive, a name, an alphanumeric name, and then a little pie chart showing the space. Now, the cool thing is that without any drivers or anything, it'll basically transfer the name that you give it to the display, which is up to 11 characters. So you can imagine that
is
pretty neat. So without without doing anything, now the only limitation is 11 characters.
Okay.
You could put your phone number, my name. Yeah. So I have it, you know, John Braun, John-Braun. And it uses something very similar. You have it in front of you there, Dave, too. But so first I was like, who the heck makes this? Because the included documentation, and, you know, every now and then you come across this, it was like, I could sense it wasn't made in this country. It was made somewhere else. But as far as I can tell, it's kind of an OEM thing. And I eventually found, by using some Google foo, it said model DD01. So I finally found the company that makes it. DidiGo, I think, is the name of the company. And they call this USB flash drive with LCD display. Doesn't need any drivers, Mac or PC. But it has this thing called a bistable cholestric liquid crystal display. Is that how you would pronounce that?
That's how I would pronounce it, yeah.
So to me, it sounds like a very similar technology, and this is very exciting, I think, just in general, is that you can now get these displays, LCD-like displays, that don't need power to maintain their output. And this is exactly what this thing does. I mean,
Let me ask here to clarify that. The display requires power to change it, but once it's set to something, you can take power away. You unplug it from your computer, and the display still retains whatever was on it the last time you changed it while it was plugged in.
Exactly. So what happens is, and all I can imagine is that, you know, I mean, to maintain a USB drive anyways, you got to know the name of the drive. It's buried in there somewhere in the drive. So I can imagine what they do is they have a little piece of, you know, firmware in this drive that says, hey, the name changed. Let me write it to the display. But I can just imagine the uses for this. I mean,
oh, yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I was alpha geek for like a day at work because I'm like, check this out. And I'm like, what? And I've never seen one of these before. But the big challenge was tracking down the company. And so the weird thing is that the company that makes it, I'm assuming they're over in China or Japan, doesn't have a way to buy the device.
Right.
But if you do a bit more Google foo, now I couldn't find it. It said model DD01.
Yep.
But actually, I did Frugal. So the first thing I did, so one geeky sideline, and then we'll get back to how I found it, is that a lot of devices, if you wonder who makes them, if you plug them into your computer and then you do About This Mac and More Info, that runs the Apple System Profiler. So one thing you can do is if you have a USB device, if you click on that part of the System Profiler under Hardware, it'll show you Vendor ID. Now, this is something much like the MAC address of an Ethernet adapter. It's unique to each vendor. And so this one was 07CC. And I'm like, well, that's interesting. So let me go online, do some more Google foo, and say, let me search for Vendor ID. And I found a page. I'll link to it. But basically, that is someone called Kerry Computer Engineering Company Limited, which, yeah, again, I think it's over in China somewhere.
Okay.
By searching for them, it eventually got me to the webpage that describes the product. The thing is, to invoke evil some more Google foo, is I actually had to search on the term, not the model number, but when I went to Frugal, which, of course, is Google's, you know, little shopping site.
Yeah.
It brought me to a couple of sites. When I did a search with just regular Google, I found people like in Australia, New Zealand. So I guess they do worldwide distribution. But searching through Frugal, I found a couple of vendors by searching on that bistable cholestric LCD display.
Oh, cool.
That sell it in the U.S. So
maybe you'll put a couple of those in the show notes.
Just no. Yeah, I'll do it. So a couple of vendors. So they got a weird kind of OEM deal here. And obviously, you know, handing this out at events, I guess they will, you know, if you order some from them, we'll put a custom logo on it. But I just think the future display technology is pretty cool because I never would have imagined that you could have an LCD or any display without power and it maintains it. And this is a perfect use for it.
Yeah.
You know, some people are talking about e-paper and stuff. I don't know if we're ever going to get to that point where you're going to have, you know, a sheet of paper that's an LCD-like thing. But for devices that just need a periodic update of an LCD display, this is a perfect use. So, yes, we'll link to it. So that's my, you know, again, I was alpha geek for a day for having such a cool device.
That's cool. All right. Mm-hmm. Our sponsor for this show is Barebones, and specifically their BB Edit software. Now, you all know that I use BB Edit to do a lot of things, including creating the HTML page that eventually becomes the show notes for Mac Geek Gab. With BB Edit, you can exercise total control over your text. You can do all sorts of things, and it all is done with plain text. Formatting, programming. If you've got something that you're writing in, say, C or PHP or Java, BB Edit is actually smart enough to figure out what language it is you're using and then start formatting the text, including any functions and anchors and links and all of that stuff in a way that is very easy to read and very easy to scroll through. In fact, if you've got functions, you can twist them all up and just see the function descriptor line so that you can just move through very quickly and then find the one that you want to edit, twist it down, edit the function, twist it back up, save it. Doesn't change the file at all. The file remains plain text. BB Edit does all the work inside it. BB Edit is available from barebones.com. And one of the new features is all the clipping support. So you can have all sorts of little text snippets and insert them at different points just to make your life easier. Again, BB Edit from barebones.com. And with that, We'll move on to Reuven's comment, which turns into a question, although he didn't know it when he sent it, I think.
Hello, John and Dave. My name is Reuven Steinberg. I am a listener from Israel who happens to be vacationing in the United States, catching up with family and friends, and I thought I would pass on this comment. Last year I bought a first revision MacBook Pro, and this year, 2 weeks ago, I bought the new 15-inch MacBook Pro 2.4 gigahertz, and I have been a loyal super-duper user for a while, and I thought, what a way to upgrade. I'll just image my drive, and then I'll just reinstate the image on the new computer. Well, I did, and I tried. It wouldn't let me boot, first of all. It kept blue screening from booting from the external drive, which worked with the old MacBook. So I did a very interesting thing to get around it. I think there may be some hardware incompatibility, and that's why I'm reporting this. What I did was to create an image onto an external hard drive. Then I booted from the install disk. I used the disk utility to mount the image and then to reinstate the image, or in this case, I guess, instantiate for the first time. And then I shut the PowerBook down, tried rebooting, and I got the same gray screen. So I thought to myself, this is very interesting. There must be some sort of incompatible driver or something, because the super duper had worked with my other MacBook, and the MacBook was working just fine. So what I did was I then took the install disk, and I rebooted the computer, and it said, would you like to do an in-place upgrade, which I figured would solve the driver issues. So if any of your other listeners should come across this problem, you can always get around it by forcing the image onto the disk, onto the hard drive of the computer, and then you can do an in-place upgrade, and you get to keep all your preferences and all the other good stuff that you spent a tremendous amount of time organizing so that it would be just exactly the way you like it. Anyway, thanks. I like listening, and I'll keep listening. You can reach me.
All right. Well, I appreciate a brute force effort like this, and certainly appreciate you sharing your comments with us. I would have to say that, man, there's an easier way. In fact, this is exactly why Apple created the Migration Assistant. The whole idea behind the Migration Assistant is that you either install OS X, and this would be 10.4 and later, onto your computer, or in the case of your new computer, it simply comes with OS X pre-installed on it, ready to go, all the right drivers. And as an aside, yeah, you know, just an old MacBook Pro had a completely different chipset managing the motherboard than the new one does. So it doesn't surprise me at all that some of this stuff wouldn't work. But yet your new one came with all this good stuff on it. And then you go and one of the first things it asks you when you start it up is, do you want to migrate the settings and data from an old Mac? And it will do exactly as you said. In fact, you have a couple of different levels that you can do, but the full migration pulls all the user accounts, all the data, all the preferences, and most of the system-wide settings over. There are a couple of things that it won't pull, like I think some preference panes, if they're installed globally, won't make it over, at least haven't in previous incarnations of the Migration Assistant. But by and large, you are left with 98%, if not 100%, of the functionality, data, and preference tweaking that you had. And it's no work at all. You just plug a FireWire cable in and you're done. In fact, you can even do it from a FireWire drive. It doesn't need to be connected directly to another Mac. You can do it from another FireWire drive. You can even do it from a drive, if you've got a desktop machine that can take more than one drive, you can do it from a drive that's inside your Mac. So, yeah, man, the Migration Assistant would have saved you from an admirable geeky tour that you took.
Yeah, now I explained before, but I was surprised because my experience, at least on the, I'm kind of old school, yo, with the old, PowerBook here and not the MacBook, which is what we're talking about here. But my experience, at least on the older machines, was that you could take an external drive, and it would pretty much, I mean, at least between my PowerBook G4, my Power Mac G5, I was able to interchange, and actually I found that very useful. Now, are you telling me that is not necessarily the case with the newer Macs, with the Intel Macs, that a drive that has been, an OS X drive that's been set up, you know, with all the drivers and stuff, that there are potential hiccups there?
Well, it's a different computer.
Well, no, I understand what you're saying, but he was going between similar machines. I believe he was going between two different MacBooks.
He was going
MacBooks.
From a first-generation MacBook Pro to what is a third-generation MacBook Pro, right?
So that's kind of what I'm asking. Is there enough of a difference in the... Because I always thought that, you know, OS X would have the core of what it needed. Do you see where we're going here?
Well, yeah, but OS X...
The drivers and all that are in there. They just may not be used. But my experience has been you can bop a drive between two different... You know, like in my case, a desktop and a laptop, and it'll work. And we'll give you the... And it sounds like he's a Windows guy because he said blue screen, not gray screen screen.
Yeah.
The blue screen is the popular term.
That's right.
But do you see where I'm going with this? So is there more of a chance that if you create, you know, that an external drive will not work properly between different Intel Macs? I mean...
Well, I mean, it's a whole different chipset. The processor is different, right? Because it's going from a Core Duo to a Core 2 Duo. Now we've
You know, I'm running a PowerBook G4 and a G5, and I can take an external drive that's a full image of my PowerBook G4, plug it into my Power Mac G5, and it'll work. It'll boot.
Huh.
So that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
That's listeners, you know, let us know your experience. Yeah. But I sense there's a difference between the compatibility of an external, you know, I use a carbon copy cloner, but I think it's similar to SuperDuper.
Yeah, same sort of thing, yeah.
Okay, so, I'm with you with it.
Unless the SuperDuper made the clone without maintaining permissions, in which case it would have caused exactly this problem, regardless of how compatible the Mac is.
I found one other thing that I think is very interesting.
Yeah.
If you try to go to superduper.com.
No. I put a link in the show notes. It's a shirt-pocket.com.
Yeah.
That's where you're going.
Well, superduper.com just gives you some silly webpage.
Oh,
okay. It was just kind of funny.
Oh, all right. Then maybe they should go there. Is it safe for work?
It says, it has two quotes. It says, "Hi, how are you doing?" And then it says, "Sweet. I mean, great. Just marvelous. Welcome to superduper.com. I don't get it. And it's for sale. So if you want superduper.com,
you can have it. You could buy it, I guess.
It's a for sale. But yeah, I guess the close, I think I'm with you, is that it sounds like, you know, sometimes don't create a problem by, hats off to the effort here, but I think my creation assistant is exactly the right tool to do what you want.
Exactly.
So I don't think I'd only recommend, I think, a utility like SuperDuper or Carbon Copy Cloner as kind of a last resort, like if you're in big trouble, but not for general use, because Apple's thought long and hard about this, and hats off to the engineers that came up with the assistant, because the last time I used it, I was just freaked out.
Works great.
That I'm like, oh my gosh, my machine was essentially duplicated. It shocked me knowing what's going on underneath, that they were able to pull as much information as they did, and it was, you know, very nice work. So
yeah. All right. One last little tip here, and then we'll save the rest of this for, well, not next week, because I'm away, so I guess we're coming back in 2 weeks. Aaron writes in, "One feature of Firefox I love, the best feature since tabs, is that Firefox will restore all of your open tabs if it crashed on you or you quit. I mistakenly found this same feature in the new version of Safari. Under the history menu, there is a menu item called Reopen All Tabs from Last Session, or if you had multiple windows open, Reopen All Windows from Last Session." And sure enough, it works just like you would expect it to. And I've been running the new Safari basically since the day it came out, had no idea. So, Aaron, thank you very much for taking the time to send that in. We appreciate it.
Oh, the band.
It's time, John.
Hi, band.
Yeah. It's
Wow, time flies when you're geeking out.
I think that's a new quote. Yeah, so I'm up at the lake next week on vacation. Yeah, yes, we have the satellite link up there. No, I really don't want to use it. Not really interested. So I know Skype does.
No,
work
you gotta disconnect from the grid,
that's,
man.
That's my feeling. Yeah. So.
Yeah, well, I'm going to be here. You know, we're going to be, you know, blowing stuff up. I mean, we're going to be doing fireworks. Okay.
Oh
okay.
Yeah. Right.
So don't
that's right.
Send anybody to my house, man. We're just doing fireworks.
I thought you were having a party. I published your address in the show notes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Small gathering. But no, we are not going to be blowing things up. Just.
Hey, I'm so sure that... I went at 6 o'clock Friday, and I left my house and drove to Dracut, Massachusetts, and played a gig at the Loci. What'd you do at 6 o'clock on Friday, John?
I don't recall.
Oh, all right. Do you know if anything happened at 6 o'clock on Friday?
Oh, that thing, yeah.
So you didn't go get an iPhone, did you?
It's few and far between products that I'll buy without touching them or using them.
Yeah.
And from what I heard, I saw one, you know, if I can find the link here, but they actually had this one person who I guess thought they were extremely clever. I forget which city it was, but they were paying people so they could get to the front of the line because they thought what they do is go into the Apple store and buy all of the phones.
Oh, nice.
Not realizing that they kind of had a limited two per person and no, so you couldn't go eBay crazy.
I don't think any Apple stores ran out on Friday night. I think some ran out of the 8 gig model,
I think some of the California stores, a few, depending on like probably the flagship stores like New York City, I think, and maybe, you know, Chicago, the North Michigan Ave store, which is another very nice store. But I heard, yeah, spot outages. The AT&T stores, I think, ran out quicker because they got a smaller allotment.
Yeah, but I looked when I got home from my gig late Friday, like 3 a.m., a Saturday, really, and checked the Apple Store iPhone availability indicator on their website. And I couldn't find any stores that didn't have them for Saturday, so... There you go. Like I said, I think some only had 4 gig models. They had run out of the eights, but AT&T stores ran out. You're right. Some, not
yeah,
all.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I got one on my doorstep and it was free. Well,
we will be taking a look at one here. Yeah, as you all know, I am a Trio user. Have been for the last 2 years, and very well entrenched in being a smartphone user. I'm addicted to having my email on the phone and also liking my ability to sync with my calendar and that sort of thing. So we will be taking a look at one here probably in the next couple of weeks. And until then, you can read all the coverage, of course, at iPod Observer and Michael Johnston's iPhone Alley site because he's doing all sorts of stuff there. He was in line. He's got one. He did an unboxing. There's a video on his site, and you can check out all that. I know Andy Anatko published an article at iPod Observer today about his thoughts. Brian Chaffin his article. And Bob Levitis' review is coming to iPod Observer shortly. So let's
now, Bob,
right there.
Bob was one of the chosen, I think. He got the touch one at Macworld.
I believe that's correct. Yeah.
I believe he was one of, yeah. So now almost everybody has a chance to touch one and use it. Quite honestly, that makes me nervous. You know, I'm kind of nervous about the non-tactile keyboard deal, but I've heard mixed reviews.
Yeah. What has interested me about the reviews, and I predicted this, if any of you read any of my articles where I was interviewed and such back in January when the iPhone was announced, was and I've read some reviews today where people are saying, oh yeah, it's fantastic when you're on a call, the screen changes and there's contextual buttons that relate to the call, like you can mute the call or you can put it on you know, your headset or the iPhone's you know thing, or you can add somebody to the call, conference call.
I've never heard of that before. That's amazing.
Well, you know, and it's like, well, I can do that on my Trio. And I was actually talking to somebody today and I said, yeah, I can. Actually, my Trio does that just fine. Again, I appreciate that the iPhone's interface probably blows away the Trio, but that particular contextual functionality is available. And it's like these people were talking about it like it was, you know, the gift from the gods. And it's like, yeah, I can do that on my Trio. And they say, yeah, but you have to use a stylus. It's like, no. The buttons are big enough and made to be big enough that I can use them with my finger. Again, not discounting any of the hard work that went into the iPhone. I'm sure the interface is fantastic. It's Apple. You all know I drink the Apple Kool-Aid, but it does bother me when there's these people out there that fail to research the market in which they're writing. And that, so there you go.
I sense a disturbance in the force.
It just drives me crazy.
Your lack of faith disturbs me. Oh.
So,
now, what I did find interesting is I believe it was it Ars Technica or Engadget or maybe a few of them, but we were curious at Macworld what processor, and I think the consensus is that there's an ARM processor, which is a very popular embedded processor. So it answers the question, did they port OS X to another processor? The answer is yes. Well, but then again, OS X and next step prior to it always had the ability to target multiple processors. So that's not a surprise that they're on an ARM chip. And already you've probably seen the take aparts. You know, some crazy people.
Yeah.
Well, iFixit, I think, did they?
iFixit.
And a few other people.
Yeah.
Hey, they blew several hundred bucks and they, I mean, hey, if they can put it back together and it works, more power to them. But I think that may not be the case.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, it looks sleek. A lot of people really, I think it may raise the bar for phones. Because phones,
absolutely.
I think you and I acknowledge a lot of phones, with the exception of maybe your Trio. I mean, the interface stinks.
And even the Trio's interface it's okay, but it's limited, right? Especially the Palm OS, it's not really built for doing something in the background. Though people have figured out how to hack it and do that, like the email client I use, Chatter Email, works in the background mostly, and sometimes it causes the phone to reboot. But that's the way that it is. My phone spontaneously reboots a couple times a month.
Now I never have that with my. Although it's now probably a Battlefield phone, but the V710.
Yeah, but you don't have any third-party apps installed on it either.
No, I do. I do.
Oh, you do.
No, they have something. Well, it was kind of annoying, called Brew, which was their proprietary.
JavaScript-based
deal. But everything I've downloaded from them, I've never actually paid for an app. It's like, excuse me, you want me to pay for an application to run on my phone?
Yeah.
But the free trials I've run, I've never had one crash it. So. Anyways, hey, but it sounded like a big success.
Yeah. And we'll take a look at one. I'm excited to look at it. Don't get me wrong. My lack of faith toward the uninformed pundits out there is not to be confused with my lack of excitement. And there is that little itch. It's like I want to go touch it and play with it. And I want one. But I'm not convinced that I could actually switch to using it. But that remains to be seen. So I will reserve further judgment on the device until I get to touch it. I will stand and judge all day the people that write about them that clearly don't know the market, though, because it drives me crazy.
Yeah,
and with that, I think we should
move. Because right now, I'm... Oh, should we? Oh, gosh.
No, it's okay. Say what you're going to say. Say what you're going to say. Go ahead.
I was going to say is actually my phone is on its last legs right now. So I think this is designed into Motorola phones.
Oh, yeah.
That the recharger connector breaks after a couple of years. So right now what I'm doing is I'm charging batteries with an external charger, which I was able to find, no thanks to the Verizon people who told me it didn't exist. But anyways, so I have an external charger and I swap the battery out instead of charging in the phone because something's loose there. But I'm not desperate enough yet to leap at the iPhone there. And the big problem, I think, and a lot of people have, and depending on where you are, is the network. But I like Verizon. I'm in the Northeast. It works pretty good. I don't know about the AT&T network, but I actually heard,
this is an interesting report,
some states, I think it was like, was it North Dakota? Some middle America states, I think, you can't find an Apple store or an AT&T store or necessarily get AT&T/singular coverage. So that's kind of annoying. So they're, but hey, okay. But you're on them now? You're on...
I've been on
AT&T
singular
network currently?
Or AT&T many, many years. Well, I moved to it. I think I had it since I was in Austin. I've been on AT&T forever. Yeah. So, all right.
Okay,
you can ponder the Motorola cell phone breaking the charger connector conspiracy for 2 weeks, and then we're back whatever that day is. So that would be the 16th of July.
Wow. I get a vacation.
There you go. You get a vacation. All right. CashFly Hosting is where you downloaded this show from. There is the A5 desktop speakers from Audio Engine, BB Edit from Barebone Software, one free download from Audible as long as you click the link in the show notes, and Page Sender from Smile on My Mac. Thank you very much for staying subscribed. We look forward to seeing you when we get back from vacation in 2 weeks.
And, and the comments. Thank you. iTunes comments, we saw them. Yes, we love them. Keep them coming.
And you've got 2 weeks, so be careful and don't get caught.
Made up.